Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Dan Savage, author of the rollicking memoir, The Commitment, Love, Sex, Marriage, and My Family, published by Penguin. In the weeks to come, we have Charles Blackstone, Lemony Snicket, Walter Kern, Nicholas Sparks, Will Arntz, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute. It's time to begin.
Good evening. On behalf of the Tattered Cover Bookstore, it's my pleasure to welcome you and to thank you for supporting your local independent bookstore. Dan Savage is the editor of Seattle's weekly newspaper, The Stranger. He is also a contributor to NPR's This American Life, and his articles have been widely published. But most of you may be familiar with Dan through his sex advice column. Not only is Savage Love carried here in Denver in Westward, but it is syndicated internationally and is read by millions of people each week. But if you think Dan only knows about sex, think again. Dan's award-winning memoir, The Kid, was an extremely honest account of the journey that he and his boyfriend Terry took to adopt their son DJ. And tonight, Dan has returned to the Tattered Cover to share some of the insights that his family gained on another monumental journey, the trip to the altar. Would you please join me in congratulating Dan Savage on the publication of his new book, The Commitment.
Thanks for coming out. It's such a gorgeous night. I would be out for a bike ride if I were you, but I'm glad you're here. You guys are so lucky in Denver. This is such a gorgeous bookstore. To have an independent bookstore. So many cities don't have an independent bookstore anymore, but to have an independent bookstore that's so large and so well run and so beautiful, because it is a beautiful public space, is a real privilege these days. Not that I have anything against the Barnes & Noble's outlets that are selling my books. But anyway, I'm going to read a couple of short chunks of the book, and then we'll get to a Q&A, because that's my favorite part of everything. I kind of work in a Q&A format at all times, professionally in my Q&A advice column, and of course at home with a seven-year-old where everything is, why? Fortunately at home, because I said so works, whereas that doesn't work very well in an advice column as much as I would like it to. I wrote this book about gay marriage almost against my will. I'd started out writing a book about my grandparents' house, as dull as that sounds. I wanted to write about the way I grew up, because white, working class, and middle class Americans don't grow up that way anymore. My great-grandparents bought a two-flat apartment building in Chicago in 1916. Two-flat means two apartments, flat roof. And my grandmother, or my great-grandmother, brought up her eight kids in one of the three-bedroom apartments, while another relative brought up her eight kids in the other apartments. There were 20 people in six bedrooms and two bathrooms. My grandmother's generation, she brought up her six kids in one apartment, while another relative, coincidentally enough, brought up her six kids in the other apartment. And my mother brought up her four kids in the same apartment. And I, of course, have one child, and that's just the history of the Irish in America. Eight kids, six kids, four kids, one kid. And a gay adoptee kid being the last one. And I wanted to write about this house because it was such an interesting way to live, and people don't live like that anymore. And I actually think, for all of the religious rights efforts to tie every dysfunction to everything that they disapprove of, like evolution, homosexual openness, free thought, rap music, the thing that I think correlates with divorce and child abuse and spouse abuse is the way we live now in these nuclear families isolated in their little houses in the exurbs without anyone around to help them. If Andrea Yates had been living with her grandmother and great-grandmother, her kids' great-grandmother and grandmother, maybe they wouldn't have drowned the kids, because they would have had some help and eyes around. I like to think that my father wouldn't have beat up my mother even if we had lived in isolation, but it probably acted as some small deterrent that my 6'8" grandfather lived in the same house with my 5'8" dad. And I like to think that we wouldn't have been sexually abused if we'd lived in the suburbs, but we weren't living in our house. And maybe that had something to do with the fact that there was no such thing as privacy. You can't really rape anyone if you can never be alone with them. What a dark beginning. Sorry about that. I'm at this point in the book tour where I just don't even know what I'm saying anymore. I want to read this little chunk of the book about what a terrible parent I am. Because when you write about being a parent or write about family, you often end up in the position of having to fillet yourself about what a good parent you are. And so the New York Times excerpted a part of the book that was about what a great parent I am. And so I feel sort of honor-bound to read about what a bad parent I am for balance, because all parents are bad parents and good parents. Hopefully you want to be in roughly equal measure. But anyway, here's a little bit of the book. Do you know who Patty Calhoun is? She took me out and got me drunk right before I had to walk over here. So blame her for this rambling opener. Please come in, sit down. My boyfriend and I took a road trip from Vashon Island, where we live in Puget Sound, to Michigan and back in the summer of 2004 when the gay marriage issue was exploding. And just kind of what the book is about. Oh, the book was about my grandparents' house. And then my editor called me when I had almost finished it and said, no, we want it to be about gay marriage because of all this gay marriage bullshit in the news. And that's why it's about gay marriage. See, there was a point to that whole conversation. God darn it. Anyway, my boyfriend thought it would be a fun idea to drive to Michigan and back. And I'm a city kid and a blue stater. I hope you'll be blue staters in 2008. My feeling was, you know, red states you fly over and wave at. You don't drive through them. I thought we were going to get killed, and obviously we didn't. Here's the book. But we did learn that driving through red states is like going on an African safari. You're safe so long as you stay in the car. Anyway, here's a little chunk of the book. What a long setup about what bad parents we are. It's called The Long Drive Home. I was convinced there would be a knock on the door and we would both be arrested. We were spending the night in a small motel in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, that shared a parking lot with an enormous Home Depot. Seattle was days away, and Terry, he who has to do all the driving, if you read Savage Love, you know how I love acronyms, so I make him into HWHTDATD, had collapsed into bed the moment we opened the door to our room. Despite the fact that Dan, he who reminds Terry every morning that we could have flown to Michigan, HWRTEMTWCHFTM, was just as exhausted as HWHTDATD, it was HWRTEMTWCHFTM who got stuck with walking the damn poodle and getting DJ into PJs. A note about the poodle. We own a poodle. It wasn't burden enough for our son to have gay male parents. We got him a poodle. Just to ensure that he gets the crap kicked out of him every day in junior high. Actually, it was his idea. He had a friend with straight parents who had poodles. They breed poodles at their house, which sounds dirty, doesn't it, when you say it that way? And his friend had a poodle bred by his parents. And so DJ had to have a poodle, too. He will live to regret that choice. And if you had told me when I was young and gay and coming out that one day I would own a poodle... HWHTDATD refuses to believe, that's Terry, that being a passenger in a car on a road trip is anywhere near as exhausting as being the driver. HWRTEMTWCHFTM begs to differ. For while HWHTDATD sits in the driver's seat, concentrating on the road ahead and blocking out everything that's going on inside the car, HWRTEMTWCHFTM has to keep the six-year-old in the back seat entertained, which requires HWRTEMTWCHFTM to spend a lot of time twisted around in his seat, loading movies into a portable DVD player, offering snacks, and cleaning up spills. HWRTEMTWCHFTM also has to act as valet and butler to HWHTDATD, getting him drinks and snacks, reading maps for him, and feeding CDs into the car stereo. And HWRTEMTWCHFTM is never allowed to put in a CD that he might like to listen to. The driver picks the music, says HWHTDATD. If you want to pick the music, learn how to drive. After 10 hours on the road, Terry, I shall retire the acronyms now, and I were barely speaking, so I was actually relieved when he went right to sleep. But then, in my hurry to get to bed, I made what turned out to be a near-fatal mistake. Instead of making DJ take a shower before bed, after we'd walked the dog around a couple of sad-looking shrubs in the Home Depot parking lot, I decided to let him take one in the morning, before breakfast. Big mistake. DJ had been sitting in a warm car all day long. Air conditioning can only do so much in July in the Midwest. And the combination of a six-year-old's wipe job after a truck stop bathroom break and all that sweat and inactivity had tragic consequences. Diaper rash. Diaper rash on a kid who's been out of diapers for 4 years. Now, I have felt like an incompetent parent on plenty of occasions. I didn't feel too bright, for instance, the time I left my overnight bag sitting open on the kitchen floor after returning home from a trip. After I used the bathroom, I walked back into the kitchen to discover my 2-year-old son gnawing on a full bottle of Xanax, looking for all the world like he was playing the lead in a preschool production of Valley of the Dolls. And there was the time I accidentally put a $5 bill under DJ's pillow. His first baby tooth had fallen out earlier in the day, and it was up to me, the insomniac parent, to replace the tooth under the pillow with a $1 bill in the middle of the night. But in the dark, I took a $5 out of my pocket and put that under his pillow. This not only set an expensive precedent, it also earned me the lasting resentment of the parents of all of DJ's friends. And then there was the time I taught DJ how to set fires in the house. We have a fireplace, and DJ likes to help bring in the wood, bunch up newspapers, and stuff them under logs when it's time to have a fire. Clearly not thinking, one day when DJ was 4 or 5, I started to show him how to perform the final step. Here's how you light the match, son. Luckily, Terry was standing right there. He won't win any parenting prizes for shouting, "What the fuck are you doing?" at the top of his lungs, forever expanding DJ's vocabulary. But his outburst did stop me from showing DJ how to play with matches. We made a big production number out of the very serious talk we needed to have about the word fuck. How it's only appropriate to use that word when something terrible happens. In the hopes that using the word fuck would seem like a larger, more tempting taboo than setting fire to all the newspapers in the living room. But my son waking up howling in the middle of the night with diaper rash at age 6... a shameful new low. What kind of parents let their 6-year-olds get diaper rash? Abusive parents, neglectful parents, meth lab parents. But I hardly had time to beat myself up for allowing this to happen before the full horror of what was unfolding in our motel room began to dawn on me. Unlike most children who get diaper rash, that would be preverbal infants, DJ has a full and colorful command of the English language. So he wasn't just sobbing, which would have merely annoyed people in nearby rooms. He was using his words, something his parents had encouraged him to do. Divorced of their context, however, overheard in a neighboring motel room, perhaps, those words had to be alarming. "Ow!" he screamed, waking us both up. "My butthole hurts! Daddy, my butt hurts! It hurts, Daddy! My butthole hurts! Make it stop! Ow, 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 ow!" The walls were thin. I had a hard time falling asleep earlier that night because I could hear the TV in the next room. And as we rushed DJ into the tiny bathroom, I worried that we weren't the only people he woke up, and that it sounded to all the world like a small child was being murdered in our motel room, or worse. And we're not even to the truly ugly dialogue yet. After taking a quick look at his butt, we realized what the problem was. DJ had the worst parents in the world and diaper rash at age 6. A few seconds later, we were sitting on the bed, Terry holding DJ's arms so he couldn't cover his butt with his hands, as I attempted to pry DJ's clenched butt cheeks apart long enough to drag a wet, soapy, and unfortunately rough hotel washcloth across his burning asshole. This charming family tableau... DJ howling and thrashing and continuing to use his words. "Don't touch my butt, Daddy! Don't touch it! It hurts! Stop, Daddy! Ow, 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 ow!" This tableau would make Gary Bauer, Jerry Falwell, and other opponents of gay adoption howl at the top of their lungs, too. After I washed DJ's butt, it was Terry's turn to pry his cheeks apart so that he could apply some antibacterial ointment he'd brought along in his bag. As the screaming and sobbing and buttholes and daddies continued, I kept one eye on my suffering son and the other on the door, waiting for the knock that would signal the arrival of the police. "It's not what it looks or sounds like, officers," I would say to the South Dakota SWAT team as it burst into the room. "It's just diaper rash and incompetent parenting, we swear to God." But there was no knock on the door. Not yet. Soon our poor traumatized son and his poor traumatized butthole began to settle. It still burned, but it wasn't on fire. The conflagration passed. Sitting on Terry's lap, tears drying on his face, DJ looked up. "Was that terrible?" asked DJ, sniffling. "Yes, it was," Terry assured him. "It was terrible. Terrible enough to use the F word." Terry looked at me. I shrugged. "If not now, when?" "Fuck," DJ said, shaking his head and savoring the moment. "Fuck, fuck, fuck." Terry laughed and kissed DJ on the forehead. "If I gotta drive," he said, turning to me, "I gotta sleep." Terry stood up and passed DJ off and treated me to an awesome display of one of his parental superpowers, the ability to fall instantly asleep, no matter what the circumstances. With Terry snoring softly on my right, DJ cuddled up in the crook of my left arm, and my heart still pounding against my ribcage, I lay in bed waiting for the knock on the door that I still expected to come. Surely the police, or whatever passes for Child Protective Services in a place like South Dakota, were on their way. After all that screaming and sobbing and buttholes and daddies, how could they not be? Every minute that ticked away was a relief. Soon DJ was asleep. Unable to sleep myself, I flipped on CNN and caught up on the Scott Peterson trial. Gee, I thought to myself, maybe we lucked out. Maybe no one in the motel called the police. An hour and a half later, 2 hours after DJ woke up screaming, my relief that no one had called the police was replaced by anger. A 6-year-old boy screams bloody murder in a motel room for 30 minutes and no one calls the police? What the fuck is wrong with people in South Dakota? Okay, well, that's a little bit of that chapter. No, don't clap. It makes me really nervous. When you write for a living, you never see other people, except for people you're related to, and you hardly talk to them at all. And then you get to go on book tours where suddenly there's all these people. And the only people you see while you're working on a book are like people in porn websites that you go into for a little break every now and then. And they don't clap when you're finished. And so it's a little unnerving. The book is basically ended up being about my grandparents' house, but more entertainingly, I was sort of caught between a rock and a hard place, the rock being my mother and the hard place being our son. Because as the gay marriage debate roared, Terry and I found that we couldn't avoid the debate about what we were going to do, particularly after Massachusetts said their Supreme Court that it was in the best interests of gay and lesbian couples with kids to marry. The irony, and kind of what the book is about, is, you know, I have two relatives, one who is in our face really rabidly pro-gay marriage, we had to get married, and one who is as rabid against gay marriage. And I have a 65-year-old, these two people are my 65-year-old Catholic mother, who was raised in the church, and my 6-year-old son, who was raised in my house. And guess which one was pro-gay marriage? My mother. And which one was rabidly anti? My son. And it was sort of an interesting dilemma. And the book is sort of about how we resolve this conflict. Because I think, and this is sort of jumping ahead to the Q&A a little bit, maybe, one of the things that's really interesting about the whole legalization of gay marriage in Canada, Spain, Massachusetts, is there are fewer gay couples marrying than they expected there would be. That the census data in Canada shows all these same-sex couples, and the marriage licensing offices don't show as many turning up for their marriage licenses. And I think there's a great deal of ambivalence in this book. I love the cover art, which is by Kate Thompson. It's the word, the commitment, literally jumping through the gold hoop, the gold wedding band, which I think captures, I think, the ambivalence a bit that we felt, that we did feel like we were being forced to jump through this hoop that we weren't sure we wanted to jump through. And I think what it is for a lot of gay and lesbian couples, and I think there's some gay men in the room with us tonight, and lesbians. I'm 40 years old. I came out when I was 15-ish. No one comes out all in one day. Came out when I was 15, 16, 17, 18. When I came out at 15 to my older brother and some friends, and 18 to my mother, and you were saying as a teenager, you're making some really profound life choices. You were saying, I want to kiss boys, first and foremost. You're also saying, I want to live with some integrity. I want to be honest about who I am. I don't want to find some poor Catholic lady and lie to her for 60 years and be miserable and make her miserable. I want to be happy, and I want to have some integrity. You were also sacrificing something, a lot of things. You were never going to get married. You were never going to have kids. There were jobs you could never have. There were places you could never live by coming out 25 years ago, 35 years ago, 40 years ago. So much has changed just in my lifetime. So much more is possible for gays and lesbians that many of us, you know, I'm 40, as I said, are being forced to revisit and reopen discussions and revisit decisions we made 25 years ago, a quarter of a century ago, things that we never thought we'd really be confronted with or have to think about, like marriage. I think it's different for younger gays and lesbians because the marriage debate's really been going on all of their adult lives, whereas for me, it didn't. It was not an option. And I think there's a sense of ambivalence on the part of many gays and lesbians. So the book isn't just about, yay, we can get married, we're going to run off and get married. The book is really about whether we want to do this or not. So many straight people we know don't want to do this. But that's not what this chunk I'm going to read to you is about. The book is really mostly funny, I hope. I want to read a little bit about being a sex advice columnist, because it's what I do. Anyway, am I boring you? Is this valuable? I'm so wrecked by... I think it's the altitude. I had two drinks. And I think that Patty Calhoun slipped me a roofie. God knows what happened before the dessert came. There's a mental image none of us need. Me and Patty Calhoun getting it on. Enjoy! I'm making fun of myself there, actually. Not like. Anyhow, if you're thinking about marriage or thinking about cake, especially if you're me, because I'm kind of a cakeaholic. I have a cell phone, too. It could be mine going off. Don't worry about it. And I love cake, and it was one of the temptations to actually do the deed. And there's a chapter called Five Cakes where we think about cake. And the subheads are green cake, peach cake, wedding cake, my cake, and kink cake. And I'm going to read kink cake because it's fun and dirty, and that's what I do. Being a sex-advised columnist, particularly one who believes that people should enjoy their kinks, gives you a license to be nosy about other people's sexual interests. Take, for instance, the cake fetishist I met after giving a talk at a large university in the Midwest. Before I get to the cake fetishist, though, a word for all the advocates of abstinence education out there. Thanks. The brand of sex education you're pushing, so little useful information, so much misinformation, means I will never be out of a job. I get questions every day from teenagers who think they can't get pregnant the first time they have sex, that you're still a virgin if you only have anal sex, and that you can contract AIDS just by walking into a banana republic. Since 18-year-old high school seniors don't magically become informed, sophisticated 18-year-old college freshmen the day their parents drop them off at the dorms, universities pay me thousands of dollars to come in and undo some of the damage done by abstinence education in an evening. It's a nice sideline, one I'm grateful for, and I will name my second home Abstinence Manor. When I do a speaking gig at a college, I take questions two ways. Students can raise their hands and ask in front of their friends and classmates, or they can write questions down on 3x5 cards before the talk starts. Predictably, live questions tend to be about politics, and anonymous cards tend to be about sex. At one particularly memorable gig, I got a question about how one reveals a secret kink to a non-kinky partner. The person who wrote the question didn't mention what this kink was. If your mystery kink is extremely revolting or extremely rare, I said, offering up my boilerplate response to the what do I do about my kink question, you might want to use the internet to seek out like-minded pervs. But if it's something mild, something on the order of a foot fetish or a thing for being spanked, share that info with your sex partners. But do it, present it to them like it's no big deal. If you don't present it like it's a problem, your partner is less likely to regard it as one. Present it as a perk, as if it were something that made you an even more fun, more interesting sex partner than they already know you to be. After the talk, I noticed this impossibly good-looking guy lurking at the back of the auditorium. I could tell he wanted to ask me about something, but by the time I answered the questions of the other students who hung out after the talk, the good-looking lurker was gone. At this particular university, speakers are put up at a small on-campus hotel right off the quad, something the lurker apparently knew, because he was standing in the lobby when I got back to the hotel. He walked up and introduced himself. "I'm the one who asked the question about being kinky," he mumbled. The advice I gave wasn't helpful, he went on, because his kink was both extremely rare and extremely mild. So what's the kink? I said. He blushed and said he didn't want to say. I offered to give him some advice, but he would have to tell me what the kink it was we were talking about. Otherwise, he was wasting my time and his. He still couldn't bring himself to tell me. So I started rattling off kinks in a loud voice in the lobby. Is it feet, diapers, amputees, incest, piss, scat, BBWs, pegging, balloons, smokers, bondage, S&M? No, it wasn't anything like that, he said. He wasn't into anything extreme, he emphasized again. His fetish was actually kind of sweet. And it wasn't what his fetish was that was problematic, but that he'd never ever heard of anyone else who shared his fetish. After making me promise not to tell anyone, after making me promise not to tell anyone he knew, I didn't know anyone he knew, I pointed out, he confessed. He had a thing for birthday cakes. Specifically, he got off on having birthday cakes smashed in his face. I know what you're thinking. He was pulling my leg. I assure you, dear reader, he wasn't, and we will get to exactly how I verified that in a moment. But I didn't doubt his fetish, because it was actually a combo of two other well-known, if rare, fetishes. There are people who get off on having pies smashed in their faces. It is a humiliation humor thing, the result of exposure to Three Stooges and Ringling Brothers routines as a child. And there are people into wet and messy sex, or rolling around in baked beans, mud, condiments, whatever, and getting all sloppy, filthy, and harmlessly dirty during sex. Since I was familiar with both fetishes, although not intimately so, it didn't strike me as impossible that I was standing in a hotel lobby having a conversation with a straight boy who fantasized about pretty girls smashing birthday cakes in his face. After asking him if I could take some notes, I began to lob questions at him. How long had he been into this? Forever. Had anyone ever hit him in the face with a cake as a child? Not that I remember. Did he have any special cake preferences? Layer, not sheet. They're thicker, so it takes longer for your face to go all the way through. How old was he the first time he smashed a cake into his own face? 13. How old was he the first time someone else smashed a cake into his face? He let out a little sigh. No one else has ever done it to me, he said. My heart broke. Let me read that whole sentence. My heart broke when he told me that the one and only time he told a girlfriend about his fetish, she promptly dumped him. Since then, he'd been too afraid to tell anyone else. That girl was an idiot, I blurted out. You're gorgeous. I'd smash a cake in your face in a fucking heartbeat. With God as my witness, I swear it wasn't an offer. I meant it as a joke and a compliment. I wasn't making a pass at the impossibly handsome cake fetishist. I wasn't! And I'll tell you why. He was straight. I was gay. It was late. I am not generally attracted to straight guys. And besides, it wasn't like I had birthday cake up in my room. But his eyes lit up like a kid's on Christmas morning when I said I'd smash a cake in his face, and I was totally unprepared for what he said next. Do you mean it? Would you? Sure, I would. I guess, I mean, why not? I stammered. He looked so fragile, like he might shatter if I refused. But we don't have a cake, and I'm not exactly a pretty girl, and I have a really early flight. I don't care that you're not a girl. I'll go get cake. If you're serious, if you're not just making fun of me. What could I do? What would you do? What would Jesus do? Half an hour later, he was back at my hotel with not one, but two store-bought layer cakes. After an awkward few moments spent making small talk, I asked him if he still wanted to go through with this. I wanted to make sure he wouldn't regret squandering his cake-smashed-in-face virginity on a gay guy. He reassured me that he wanted to do it. He got undressed and knelt in the bathtub. I remained fully clothed. This was about his needs, not mine. Really, for me, this was research. Me, Jane Goodall, him, chimp. Although the sight of this boy naked was reward enough. The girlfriend who dumped you was a fool, I told him as I lifted the lid off the cake. Now close your eyes and pretend I'm Hillary Swank. So that's, don't clap, makes me nervous. Two things I feel like I have to qualify at this point, because I get all these angry emails after I read that thing anywhere. Did I violate this person's privacy viciously? Yes. But I got his permission, because after we had our big chat, after he masturbated, covered in cake frosting and globs of cake everywhere, which was not an arousing sight, at that point he might as well have been a chimpanzee covered in his own feces, masturbating behind the plate glass at the ape house at the zoo. It kind of, like, all the cake and crap kind of obscured everything that was delightful looking about him. After he climaxed, I hadn't seen anybody shoot that far since the Challenger exploded. We exchanged email addresses because I offered to talk his next girlfriend down. That the next time he met a girl and wanted to do this with her, I would, like, explain to her what it meant. Not only what his fetish meant and how harmless it was and that she should indulge him, but also the karma rule of dumping people who are kinky, which is if you dump somebody for a harmless-ish, easily indulged fetish like this, or a foot fetish, or spankings, you will dump that person, and I guarantee you will marry the necrophiliac. Only the necrophiliac won't tell you until the wedding night, until it's too late. So if you meet a foot fetishist, you should thank your lucky stars that they're not a poo eater, or a necrophiliac, or a horse fucker, and stick your foot out and let him go to town, ladies. So I actually emailed him and said, I want to put this in the book, and we'll obscure you a little bit. So there's no physical description, just handsome. So any handsome guy you meet anywhere in the Midwest could be this guy. So this is the Q&A section of the I'm drunk and at a high altitude reading. I need your cues or you can't have my A. Yes? Over the last 7 years, we've had intermittent contact with DJ's mom. It's been a little frustrating. I write about it in the book. It's not a tragedy. I wrote the New York Times excerpted the chunk of the book about DJ's mom and us. And it was weird to read the letters about it in the New York Times, because people were like, oh, you know, this private tragedy has been dragged out into the public. DJ's mom was a homeless street kid. I notice you have a few here on 16th. Does the whole circuit through the country asking for spare change, very proud of her survival skills, being able to live on the streets. Consequently, however, is impossible to get a hold of. And so sometimes we're in this position of not hearing from her for 6 months or a year, and DJ getting upset, and us as parents not knowing which stick, you know, which 2x4 to bash him in the face with. Your mother's out there and doesn't care enough to call, or by all likelihood at this point is dead. You know, we wrote all about this and this dilemma, and to hear it called, it's called a tragedy, I found kind of shocking, because DJ's mom had the presence of mind to know that she was not a fit parent and was also responsible enough the instant she discovered that she was pregnant to stop drinking and stop using drugs, unlike a lot of people, including my parents, and find parents that could take care of this kid and do an adoption and get off the streets for a while and take care of herself because of this kid. I don't think that's a tragedy. That's kind of, in my view, that's sort of a success story for an adoption. The tragedy are people who are unfit parents who keep their kids and kill them or torture them to death or abuse them until they're just fucking warped adults. So the journey with DJ's mother has been long and strange and ups and downs, but totally worth it. And not just worth it because DJ is such a great kid and we love him so much, but we're good for him, we're good for her, she's good for us. And it is what it is. And it's not a tragedy because the story's not done. We'll see how it turns out. And then maybe someone can still try to call it a tragedy. I don't think it's a tragedy. Does DJ read any of my stuff? No. Nor will he. We're going to... I'm going to tell him my pen name is Abigail Van Buren. Daddy's an advice columnist. Here he is in the daily papers. When he takes an interest in it, he can read it. He's reading chapter books now. He's 7 years old. We're big readers, so he's like a reader. You know, we're fascist parents about television a little bit, but not totally fascist. He can watch as much TV as he wants from Friday night to Sunday morning. And he binges and we purge. But when it's time, he'll read it. You know, one day his 15-year-old friends are going to read the chapter about his asshole to him. And we expect he'll have issues with that. And we'll say, did you like that roof over your head? But that's the problem when you're like married to or related to or born to or adopted by writers, your mind. And, you know, we would put money in his therapy and college funds. No, I know what you mean. You can't, being gay parents is to be dragged out in every possible situation. There is no in anymore. It really isn't an option. People look at you in truck stops in South Dakota and they know. They hear your kid call both of you daddy, and your kid runs up to their kid and says, my two dads. And then there's this moment of like, well, what the fuck's going to happen? What I think is interesting about having been gay parents, Jesse Green, you said this in his book, The Velveteen Father, and I always mention it and cite it because it's absolutely the truth. Parenthood trumps gayness. Even people who cannot deal with you as a gay person can relate to you as a parent. And so people who may not be able to, who don't want to sign off on, don't approve of, have a problem with the whole boy on top of boy thing, or man on top of man at this point, can, like, parenting is this, like, wonderful, like, smokescreen. They don't even see you as a gay person anymore, because straight parents hardly see themselves as heterosexual anymore. And so that works in our favor. Also, straight people, even straight people who disapprove of gays and lesbians, are often fundamentally decent human beings. Sometimes they're fundamentally fucked in the head, but they're still fundamentally decent. You have to be a really fucked up motherfucking asshole to blow up in front of a 5-year-old at his parents about their sexuality and about who they are and about his family structure. It has never happened to us. Once, this woman in a park who was probably just a crazy bitch, you know, asked where the mom was, and we said we were adopted, and she stormed off in a huff. DJ was, I think, a month old. He doesn't remember it. So that's worked out great for us. We don't live in Mississippi, nor do we vacation in Mississippi. So we sort of have a buffer around us. But we haven't encountered it, and we go everywhere. You know, we travel. We've been to the weirdest places we've gone haven't been in America. They've been in Europe. Because although we like the gays and lesbians in America like to say, oh, there's so much freer there, and gay marriage in Spain, gay marriage in Holland, gay marriage in Belgium, civil unions in France, now civil unions as of December in the United Kingdom, they've got gay marriage and they don't have gay adoption or access to artificial insemination for lesbians. So they're getting married, but they're not having kids, nor are they allowed to have kids. And we're having kids, but we're not allowed to get married in most places. So a gay couple arriving in a place like, as we have many times, a conservative place like Munich, where we go on vacations all the time because we love it, there's nothing quite like watching your son drink in the bar where Hitler drank. it's sweet. You know, people don't know quite how to deal with you. Like, gay people don't know how to deal with you. We went to Paris and stayed in the Marais, which is like the gay neighborhood. We brought a friend and her kid so that Terry and I could go out at night. And so during the daytime, we were all over the Marais, the two of us with this baby, this 3 or 4-year-old at the time. And at night, we were out, the two of us in gay bars drinking, and the same guys who'd seen us in the street all day would see us in the gay bar, and they're like, they'd come up to us and go, who the fuck are you and what is this baby? Anyway, it blew their minds. But no, it's been fine. We haven't had a problem yet. Then again, we haven't been in a car accident in Florida or Oklahoma, where if something should happen to DJ while we were there, he's technically legally a ward of the state, because those states don't recognize our adoption. So we're not going to Florida. We'll fly to fucking Munich. And that's what we call it in front of DJ, fucking Munich. One of the things that was surprising about becoming a parent is how early in life you hear this inflection, Dad. I thought that came at like 11. It comes at like 4. And that's probably all he'd be doing is going, John. But he'll be doing it at some point. Maybe he'll have a book in him. Who knows? the children's books that out there are great. You know, so many of them aren't, don't endorse or even feature one family structure over another. And we go out of the way to like make sure there are books that have gay families, as any gay family does. We also go out of the way to make sure there's sort of proportional books that have straight families. You know, the odds are he's going to be straight when he grows up. And so we're not, I've met gay parents who only have books with gay families in them, in their house. And I think that's nuts. Because your kid is 95% certain to be a breeder as an adult. And you might want to role model that a little too. And they might want to know that their family structure is unique and not be shocked when they get to grade school and find out that everybody doesn't have two dads named Marv, as is the case in this family. All kids have two dads and they're all named Marv. The only children's book I want to write is a funny one, because one time when DJ was two, we went to Amsterdam, just the two of us, me and Terry. My mother, the first bit of advice she gave us when we became parents was take advantage, which is what the kind of advice her family gave her, which is, we're here, you go. Like, remember why you liked each other well enough to want to do this, which you can only really do when you're alone. Like, when you have your kid with you, you're the two-party system. All parents, all families with two parents in the same house, it's the Democrats and the Republicans sleeping together. It is very stressful. There's something I think evolution hardwired about it. Whatever Terry decides, I leap to the opposite decision so that we can have a fight about it. And then in that conflict, usually the best idea wins. That's the two-party system. It can be very stressful to live like that all the time, but you do when you're parents. So sometimes you have to be alone together. My mother's very... Anyway, she sent us to Amsterdam for a week when DJ was two. And the whole time we were gone, DJ thought we were in Hamsterdam. He thought we went to the country where people are hamsters and that we were sleeping in wood shavings and running in habit trails. And I want to write a book about Hamsterdam. That's the only one I want to write, because I think Hamsterdam is a really cool idea. Mike Huckabee off camera is a stinking hypocrite. They all are. You can't at once argue that gay and lesbian people are, as James Dobson has said, a threat to the survival of the planet, and then trade quips with us backstage in the green room before you go on television with us and trade quips with us about the gay issue. Like, if you really believe that we are global warming and a comet both together speeding at the planet, I don't know why you can be chummy with me if I'm all that bad. You know, and I kind of nailed him on the show, because if you didn't see it, there was the California Supreme Court ruled that in a custody dispute where there's a same-sex couple with a kid, they both have to be treated as legal parents in deciding custody, child support, visitation, even if one of them has no genetic or biological relationship to the child, that they're both parents. And Marr threw that out in front of Huckabee, who's the governor of Arkansas, anti-gay marriage psycho, who lost a lot of weight. More power to him. I want him to lose the other 180 pounds. That's the meanest thing I've ever said, even meaner than the challenger. Huckabee said, well, it's in the best interest of the child, therefore I support it, which is insane. It's in the best interest of that child that the parents be married prior to their divorce. The position of the religious right increasingly is, we will treat same-sex couples as married when they break up. So we get all the shitty end of this marriage stick and none of the benefits. In Washington State, where I live, you are legally married when you separate. Then the courts step in and they'll like determine, you know, who, alimony, division of property, all the stuff that straight people hate about marriage, you can have in Washington State if you're gay, but none of the benefits. Terry and I talk about breaking up and going through that process just so we can sue for everything we didn't get for the first however many decades we were together. We'll break up on our deathbeds and sue for the 40 years, hopefully, or 50 years of benefits we were denied. Mike Huckabee, hypocrite, asshole. Any advice for somebody, a friend of yours who's not here tonight, mid-20s, coming out, not out to parents? How long did it take? The longer you wait to start, the longer it takes for them to get over it. The older you get with them thinking one thing about you, the harder it is to pull that up by the roots and make them think another way about you. I don't think that gay people begin to mature until they come out. I've seen too many gay guys come out and they're 25 or 35 or 45 who act like 15-year-olds for 10 years. Because you don't, I think, begin to emotionally mature until you are dating the people that your heart wants you to date. So I would encourage you to come, if it's you, to come out now and not to wait. It's going to, sometimes people think I'm glib about coming out because I think if you're a grown-up, you should be out, period, end of discussion. And I reject the whole, like, mewling gay therapist, you know, only when you're ready, everybody at their own speed. Like, I think there's a lot of closet cases who need a boot on their ass about it. I'm not you, but your friend, for sure. And I'm sometimes, you know, my mother is great about us and my boyfriend and I, and she's all over our books, and my father is great, my whole family is great. My whole family wasn't great when I came out. Like, gay people make their families great by demanding it of them. And the leverage that you have is your person and not compromising your person. And your person is a gay person if you're gay. And so I do think that, you know, you have to be a human being about it, not a screaming asshole, and say, you have a year. It's kind of what I said to some of my relatives. You have a year to ask me anything and I won't blow up. I don't, whatever pops into your idiotic working class, printer, cop, fireman, Irish Catholic, whack job head, anything, I'll answer. Here are the books, read it. And then in that year, you have to be totally fucking over it. And I'm not going to deal with you anymore. And if you're shitty to me, I won't come around. And if you're shitty to me, I won't be home for Christmas. And if you're shitty to me, I won't be home for Thanksgiving. And if you're shitty to me, I'm not coming to your funeral. And that's amazing leverage. You'd be surprised how much power a lot of children have over their parents. You'd be surprised how many gay people don't come out to their parents because we're afraid of the judgment or the rejection, and we get ourselves in a position where we reject them for fear of being rejected by them. We don't give them the benefit of the doubt. We don't give them the chance to come through for us, even if it takes a couple of years. And they almost invariably do come through. Sometimes they don't. Usually, in most cases, they do, particularly these days. But you have to use, or your friend has to use herself as leverage, you know? Like having me around, like talking to me. You want your adult child to change your diapers when you're 90? Don't be a shit about this. Or you'll get diaper rash, I guarantee it. What kind of a 90-year-old gets diaper rash? I'll put that in my next book. This is actually, because I had to bust this book out, I busted this book out kind of quickly, or revised it very quickly after the gay marriage thing last November. Here we are, it's not even November and the book is out. That actually was pretty recent, and he hasn't worked up the courage to tell his current, which is a shame. But, you know, it's not an unreasonable fear in his part. A lot of young ladies are terribly ungracious and unthinking about kinks and fetishes. They all want to meet the guy who's into just completely, if they're straight, just completely normal heterosexual sex. I've never met that guy. I don't think that guy exists. Every guy is a freak. I think a freak in some respect. Every guy has something that's like from the back of the menu. And I think part of it has to do with men and women being fundamentally ill-suited to each other sexually and emotionally. Just kidding. I mean, you complement each other so well. That's what I mean. You know, the problem is gay men hit their sexual peak at about 18. And I think what happens when you hit your sexual peak is there's just all, like, the vessel can't contain your desire and it just spills out in weird ways and cracks form and the water shoots. Like, it just can't contain it. Like, it just explodes. And, you know, attaches itself to some weird stuff like birthday cakes and feet and bondage or whatever. It just like kind of goes a little nutty. And that's great. That's actually kind of fun and interesting. It's something that makes humans not dogs. Dogs fuck just one way. That's why they call it doggy style. Humans fuck all sorts of different ways, just like we use silverware and wear clothes. It makes us more interesting than dogs. The problem is that women and men don't hit their sexual peaks at the same time. I get a lot of letters from 18-year-old women who are freaked out because their 18-year-old boyfriends want a spanking or want to spank them. And they don't know what to do about it. Get a spanking. Give a spanking. That's what you do. And then I get letters from women who are 32 or 33 and they're hitting their sexual peak. And suddenly they want to do all this crazy shit. And they feel really bad about how ungiving they were at 18 or 19. Not that you have to do every goddamn idiot thing a straight guy asks you to do, ladies. I don't believe that. But they freaked out when their boyfriend wanted a spanking at 18, and now they're 33 and they want one. And they married the guy who didn't want a spanking because they dumped the guy who did. You know, and there you are. And so, careful. That's all I got to say. Careful what you wish for when you're a young person, because when you hit your sexual peak, ladies, you're going to want somebody who's in your debt. Somebody owes you because you were indulgent when they were young. And now you're like, you know what? It's time for you to wear the dog collar for a while. I am not responsible for the creation of the word sandworms. I have to give credit to my readers, because it was a reader who wrote in and suggested we have a contest to come up with a new definition for sandworm. That frothy mix of lube and fecal matter that is sometimes a byproduct of anal sex was a reader's idea, and the readers voted on many choices and chose that one. And it was a brilliant choice, because there wasn't a name for that substance. It is sometimes a byproduct because it is unwelcome. It means you're doing the anal sex wrong. What could be wronger than anal sex with Santorum in the room? Like, it makes so much intuitive sense. Like, Santorum, the substance, is as much of a buzzkill in anal sex as Santorum, the senator, wants to be. But yes, people are always suggesting that I do the Santorum to other folks. And I don't want to do it, because I don't want to, every time I have sex, I don't want to look at my honey and say, get over here and delay my frist until we Santorum the Bush and Cheney all over each other. Like, I don't want to invoke all these assholes every time I want to have sex. Oh, your Scalia is so hot. It just makes me drool when you Clarence Thomas like that. Fine. Snicker's fine. Snicker can't fly. It's one of the reasons we have to drive. If you buy the book, you can read all about the dog's near demise. Not only does DJ own a poodle, but it's a one-eyed, deaf, brain-damaged poodle. Runs into walls. If you come up on one side of it, it can't hear you or see you, and then you appear in its divided peripheral vision, and it flips out. And it's kind of like living with a spastic ottoman. Have I heard from Santorum? Not directly. And since I do anal sex right, I never see it. My goal, I haven't updated the spreadingsantorum.com site in a year or more, because my goal was to reach him. My goal was to make him think about the substance that will forever be named for him. And I have, if you go to the website, there's a letter from his office about it. There's videotape of him being asked about it. He knows. And that was the goal. And the word has actually, credit to my readers, taken root. The American Linguist Society declared it one of the best new words of 2004. And it's being used, divorced of any mention of my column or me or the campaign or the senator. It's being used in its proper way as a name for this unwelcome substance, including in, somebody sent me a link to a German porn site where it's one of those sites where it's just links to stories, not pictures, just all blah de blah de blah de blah. And it says, Ich bin nach dem Bad Santorum. So if they're using it in Germany, it worked, it worked. It's so true. Sometimes people worry me, think about those poor Santorum children. Okay. Think about our children when he runs around calling gay people dog fuckers, and that we're no better than people who fuck their children. Our children have to hear him say that. Our children have to hear him say, my child heard him say, mine, that banning marriage was a defense of homeland. It was homeland defense, banning gay marriage, and comparing gay people who want to marry each other to terrorists who bring down buildings. Fuck his kids. They should suffer. Everyone named Santorum should suffer. They should be mad at him for dragging their name into the gutter and bringing it into disrepute. Not me. Did having the kid change my perspective? No, it didn't. I was always the same sort of judgmental, obnoxious weirdo before. I have a problem with people who use kids to leverage out of their lives things they didn't enjoy doing in the first place. I liked what I was doing before I had kids. I like what I'm doing now. I didn't have a kid to escape my life, my prior life. And so, you know, sometimes when you talk to people about kids, they're like, oh, now I see what's really important, and everything I was doing before was really just so a waste. Now I'm home baking bread and reading books to my child and baby Einstein, and that's what really matters. And it's just like, shut the fuck up. That's so judgmental of people who don't have kids or haven't had kids yet. You aged out of being young and fun and drunk and having a lot of relationships or just like hanging out and having fun. You aged out of it, and you're making a virtue of aging out of it by going, oh, now I know it's really important. Like, that's just obnoxious. I'm not a different person because I have kids. I have a kid now, or kids soon, but things are now not possible logistically anymore because we have kids. So it did change our lives, but it didn't. We made those changes because the same people we were before we had kids wanted to live a different way now. And so it's not like, oh, so I'm not answering your question very well. Oh, I do. Oh, yeah, we're like, everything's in Terry's name. Nobody can find us. We live on an island in Puget Sound for a reason. You know, I have some crazy psycho stalkers, none of whom are fundamentalist Christian whack jobs, to their credit. You would think I would have like fundies kicking in my door and screaming at me. It's always gay guys who don't like the stuff I read about AIDS, who don't like the stuff I read about anything. You know, and there's sometimes this attitude in the gay community that a gay writer is not an autonomous individual with, you know, to whom the Bill of Rights apply, just like everybody else. But we're cogs in the wheels of the machinery, the movement. You can see the way people like Andrew Sullivan and Gabriel Rotello and Michelangelo Signorelli and I sometimes are abused for saying in public something that goes against the prevailing wisdom of the gay rights movement, which sometimes is not very wise. So the hate mail I get and the crazies I get tend to be fags, which is weird and off-putting. But yeah, we have to protect him, and we don't have, you know, he doesn't get to read my column. We don't keep the stranger in the house because he wants to read it and sound out words. And we're not the nudist parents. We're not nudists, and I don't mean nudist literally, but growing up when we were all kids, did you have a friend whose parents were too open about sex around you? They were trying to show their kids' friends how hip they were, and they would talk about sex and be real chummy, and it just made you want to throw up. And I always called them the nudist parents. And you just wanted them to be less comfortable talking to teenagers about sex because it made you uncomfortable. We don't want to be those parents. We're very repressed sexually in our house, and we intend to stay that way. Well, he just finished reading Genesis. Dad, it says here Adam and Eve. His logic is by the book. It's all in here. Actually, his process. It was about gender roles. Little kids snap into gender roles the minute they're in a pack. They're in a school where it's the boys versus the girls. And marriage, as Deej understood it at age 6, in sort of a, I think, appropriate way, was nuclear cooties. It was something the girls would threaten the boys with. And so the idea that a family without any girls in it would even think about marriage seemed odd to him. Because, you know, we didn't spend the first 6 years of his life going, let's talk about marriage. We said, let's take a bath. You alone, not all of us together. Because you're a kid, you need to be clean. That's your first job as a parent. Keep the shit off, keep the food going in. And so he had these weird gender notions, and it was all about talking about that. And talking about what gay meant. Because for a while he thought being gay meant you get to live with your best friend when you grow up. And what 6-year-old boy doesn't want to do that? So I actually write about this stuff in the book that makes the religious right flip, which is DJ announcing that he wants to be gay, like us. Which is what they claim to worry about, that our kids will emulate us and adopt our sexuality. We didn't do that with our parents, but our kids are going to do that with us somehow. And his part of the book is about his coming to an understanding of what homosexuality and gayness is. In an age-appropriate way. Yeah, we're so politically powerful. Look at how many gay senators there are, for instance, and how the Republicans do whatever we tell them to do. I hope we can destroy the sanctity of the Bush administration, but I don't think we need to lift a fucking finger. They're doing a great job destroying themselves, hoisted by their own petard, by their sanctimoniousness and self-righteousness and uncritical. People, you know, they're against science. They're not into critical self-evaluation, obviously. And so they're cracking up. And what did it happen a year ago instead of after the motherfucker got sworn in a second time? We have 3 more years and 3 more months of this motherfucker, January 20th, 2009. how are we going to get through it? I don't think we have the power to do that. Not cities against, but yeah, I actually, the Urban Archipelago issue, and it's still at urbanarchipelago.com, you should go read it. I think it's the key to the Democratic success. There is, if I do say so myself, when you look at the red state, blue state map, it's kind of a lie. There's no such thing as a blue state. There are red states with blue cities in it that are so blue they turn the whole state blue. There is no such thing as a blue state when you look at the county by county breakdown. The Democrats are the parties of urban America. It is the party of urban America, and they should be the party of urban America unashamedly as the Republicans are the party of rural America and exurban America. The Democrats should run to the cities. And the cities are coming back, and the cities are resurgent. And the way to flip a state like Colorado into the blue column is to build up the cities of Boulder, the cities of Denver, even the city of Colorado Springs. Because the cities that are the states that have big, successful cities that work are blue states. Washington with Seattle, Chicago in Illinois, New York in New York. The states that have big cities that are not blue are the cities that don't work, the Detroits and the Dallases, which are not urban areas. They're just suburbs with a couple of office towers in the middle of them. And so we need to run, the Democrats need to run to the city. Am I answering your question? And blah, blah, blah. And that is the future of our success. I was going to say something really relevant. And I don't remember what it was. So that can't be the last question. I'm sorry. Well, yeah, you plow Detroit under and start over again. You make the cities work. I think Richard Florida sometimes is glib, his pop sociology, but he's right. Cities that are ethnically diverse, racially diverse, religiously diverse, and diverse sexually are the successful cities. And you can't have just some of those things. You have to have all of those things. And cities are really the economic engine. And we're moving to really like all the cliches of the 90s still apply. It's going to be an intelligence economy. It's not going to be a making refrigerators and televisions economy anymore. And people need to be smart. And people need to have educations. And people need to, and as we move into the oil bust, you need things like, God bless Denver for fast tracks. We're going to need to build an urban infrastructure, just the same one that works in every other city in the world, Paris, London, Rome, New York, Chicago. It's not a coinkydink that all these really good cities have elevated trains and subways. It's part of what makes a big urban place work. And if we build up the cities, because when a city that pulls people, like the death of the rural areas, the death of South Dakota, the death of family farms, who gives a fuck? Let them die. I'm sick of subsidizing them so they can vote in the assholes who hate the cities. When we're subsidized, we pay. All the red states are welfare queens that survive on the largesse of cities. Fuck them. We should concentrate on our own issues, build up our own cities, because you know where those people are going when their family farms collapse and their rural areas dies? They're coming here, because this is where the jobs are. Even if you have to flip burgers, motherfucker, this is where the jobs are. And once you get to an urban area, you're going to be exposed to people who aren't Bible-thumping fundamentalist whack jobs in SUVs, who aren't necessarily heterosexual, or who are heterosexual but not necessarily married or living in a traditional family structure. You'll meet people who are black. You'll meet people who are from the subcontinent. You'll meet people, and you'll see that your fears are unfounded. That's how we're going to bring the country back to the Democrats and progressivism and get away from this insane, divisive, Republican, fear-mongering crap that's so frustrating. We have 2009 to wait to put it into gear. Okay, it's 1:45, so I have to shut up because the bookstore is going to close. We're going to get locked in, and I'll have to talk till 9 in the morning. What do I feel about 9/11? People shouldn't fly airplanes into buildings. I feel that Islamic fundamentalist terrorism is a real threat. And I hate the Bush administration for so bungling the war on terror and the elective war in Iraq, which I thought was a good idea actually going in, that we've fucked ourselves. That there's nothing Bush hasn't touched that hasn't turned to shit. But they really exist. They really did knock those buildings down. I sometimes have a problem with my lefty friends who act like Islamic fundamentalist terrorism is this illusory threat that Bush made up. Like, I know people who burned to death that day. They're dead. And I read about one of the families, the only complete family that died on 9/11 was a gay family. And I'm sure you never heard about them because that couldn't be reported. Gay male couple, 5-year-old adopted son on the plane that hit the first tower. And you didn't hear about them. If it had been a straight family, I bet there'd be a statue already. Anyway, blah, blah, blah. Thank you for coming. Buy my book. Thank you to the Tattered Cover.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for Charles Blackstone, Lemony Snicket, Walter Kern, Nicholas Sparks, Will Arntz, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on October 18th, 2005.